Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Drew Hodgson, you were in Baltimore just recently. You just got back, and now it makes sense why you went to Baltimore. It's because Michael K. Williams died, and you were honoring him.
I was there specifically for the event. Yeah, that's exactly right.
You had sent this to me. You said that the Ravens last week, I didn't see this. Maybe I wasn't watching the highlight shows or anything enough, but the Ravens, in honor of the death of Michael K. Williams, who played the part of Omar in The Wire, which is set in Baltimore, they did his infamous approach whistle at the game, right?
Right. Yeah.
I didn't. Look, I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't watch The Wire. I've watched like a third of an episode ever. So I watched, I'll play it right now. Then I have to check with my boss to be sure that's okay. But usually they like, usually they like you playing stuff like this because it's just a promotion. We're just doing it for editorial purposes. So, let me be sure you can hear this, and then I'll edit it out if I'm disallowed. Okay, yeah, I couldn't figure that out legally, so I'll just describe what happens. Omar, played by Michael K. Williams, is walking down the street with a long coat and a shotgun, whistling. The farmer in the dell. He doesn't sing the last part. He whistles the whole time. But innocent enough, right? A little nursery rhyme or song, and it's scary as hell because it's Michael K. Williams and he's got a shotgun, and you can see a couple younger kids just scrambling, taking off, running because they're scared bleepless that Omar is coming down the street. Now back to the show. So very menacing, this Omar character from The Wire. And I know that he played Omar on The Wire because when I was watching Boardwalk Empire, I remember telling somebody, like, dude, there's this character named Chalky White, and he's played by this dude, this unknown actor, who's just a badass. And the guy was like, yeah, you idiot. That's Omar from The Wire. I learned, oh, okay. So he's Omar from The Wire, and that's what people, probably a lot more people watched The Wire than there were people that watched that watched Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah, well, it was just, they were both really, really popular shows. I think, The Wire has just held on for so long. It's had the staying power where people like still rewatch The Wire all the time. I mean, The Wire is like in my, top three shows probably of all time. But that specific, however they decided to honor him at that Baltimore game, I'm probably like you, where I'm pretty cynical. I mean, most of that stuff like usually rings a little,
like gimmicky or something. Like what sometimes you can tell at a game back when they used to get paid for this, like the military promotions that were paid for and a little bit over the top versus like the really organic ones where it's
exactly
like when you're honoring an individual. So, okay, I got you. Yeah,
completely.
Cynical about stuff like that.
I really am. Yeah. A lot of that stuff just feels like a little forced. It feels a little like it's exploitative sometimes, and they're taking advantage of like a moment, and it's just kind of like, they're looking for a reason to market or brand something.
But this is something that the Ravens do really well. They do a lot of stuff that if not done properly would seem very tacky. But they do it, and this goes back to when they first were in Baltimore, and we would go up and play there. They have a very college atmosphere because they have a marching band. They've got like male and female cheerleaders, except they're not bound by the rules of collegiate or high school athletes, and they're tossing these women, These male cheerleaders are tossing the women like 40 feet in the air. It's freaking scary. But they also have the marching band, and then they do the, and then even the White Stripes thing, that whole I'm going to Baltimore, that song. They also mentioned Wichita in that song, but somehow it's all about Baltimore there.
Right.
Like that's that gets annoying and old, but I can totally see how if I were in Baltimore, that song would get me going.
Well, and the thing is, like, that is such a the setting in The Wire and that show is just so critical to the whole formula of the show.
Yeah.
On top of Omar just being this iconic sort of character that everybody recognizes. And so I guess that's all to say they nailed it. I mean, I was watching it and I was like getting the chills watching it. I loved it.
I've always wondered about this though, because it's not the best portrayal of the city of Baltimore, is it?
No, not at all.
No. Like it's like almost everything ugly and bad about Baltimore, except even amplified. Are the police Is Omar a dirty cop or is he a good cop?
He's not a cop.
Oh,
he's not a cop. No.
He's wearing a badge in that video I was watching.
No, he's like a vigilante drug dealer.
Oh, so is he like old school mobster that like looks out for his neighborhood?
That's why he's such an interesting character, because he's a bit of like an anti-hero.
Okay.
Because he's going around taking out other drug dealers and people that are competing with him.
But these are also, like, guys that sell the kids and stuff where like, does he have kind of a moral code about it?
Yeah, he has a bit of a code, but he's absolutely still a murderer.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where
that's kind of what he was in Chalky White in Boardwalk Empire too.
Yeah. Yeah. He was kind of like he was in Harlem representing sort of just like this class of how, you know, like minorities could get ahead in that kind of world.
Yeah.
You know? And so it was really interesting. I mean, he's great in that show.
Well,
great.
And then, so I went down this Michael K. Williams rabbit hole a little bit, and I watched videos of him dancing, because he started out as a professional dancer. He was like a backup to Madonna and people like that.
Oh yeah. And he's amazing. He's an incredible dancer too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Like, he was a professional dancer. Yeah. And Madonna only hires the best. So, it's true.
As we all know.
She put on a show. I watched that show, that movie with the bustier and everything. That was a big deal. That was the closest thing we had to actual porn.
The bustier.
Yeah.
Good God.
By Jean-Paul Gaultier. I remember that. It was whatever that book she had.
They were walking down the Champs-Élysées.
Yeah. so he was good, but I go to watch this interview, and I'd never seen an interview with him before, but I was kind of worried that it was going to be kind of a Henry Winkler type thing. Like, remember when you were a kid and the Fonz was the baddest dude on television and you thought the Fonz was so cool. And then the first time you see an interview with Henry Winkler, you're like, oh my God, this guy, what the hell? This is the Fonz? Especially as a preteen boy, it ruins your world. So I was wondering what Michael K. Williams would be like. And you can totally see how he obviously is really intelligent and sensitive and all that stuff, the things that make a good actor. But that voice and that scar and like everything about him, he still has kind of a men, even as he's being the most congenial person on earth, you could see how if he wanted to, he could scare the shit out of you. Like immediately.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, his presence. He has one of those things. It's just like pure presence.
He said he got that scar. I think he said he got that scar like in an accident on a set or on a job or something. But he said that scar ended up working out really well for him, because one of his early roles was in a Tupac movie, and Tupac saw the photo and he said, he said something like, that guy's thug enough to play my little brother or something. It was Tupac using the word thug, not me. So
don't fault
me. Those thugs. I don't. That voice was just so crazy.
Fantastic. You're gonna have to watch it now.
Yeah, I will have to. So and then I have to ask you too, because I noticed this while I was watching that video. Where do you find all these websites? You send me these articles from these websites and they annoy the ever-loving piss out of me. Remember the thing kept reloading the whole time? I think this was IndieWire.com or something.
Yeah.
Remember the time you sent me that website, that article about the girl from OnlyFans? And, you know, God bless her. She's probably broke right now because they're banning sex from the platform.
I know. Well, no, they brought it back. They made it about face. Yeah, they did a quick 180. That lasted like 72 hours. And they turned around and went like, wait a minute. Did we even talk about this?
Did you?
Before we cut our own legs off?
Do you know what happens? Without knowing anything about that story, other than like very surface level skimming the headlines, I saw people get irate about it on both directions. That this is not for me, this story. I guarantee you that was some damn executive watched a TED Talks and was like, oh, well, this is, you know, we need to aspire for more than this. And this was just our jumping off point. But this will be the moment like when the Apple II was launched or something, when we decided to go non-porn.
Yeah. Only 80% of our revenue comes from these OnlyFans users, guys. We can turn that into 75 over the next three years.
And not to mention the other 20% probably comes from people who are watching porn and then like saw like, oh yeah. I find myself all of a sudden less tense. I'd like to go watch some jazz music.
Yeah, so I'll go. Right. Yeah, that's the parlay into the other.
That 20% was getting led to by the other offerings. Yeah,
that would be a wild metric if it were porn number one, jazz streaming number two.
Okay, now the one newsy thing that I want to bring up, because this is a side of the NFL that not a lot of people know about or would know about. But I just found myself fascinated by offensive tackle Lyle Collins from the Cowboys apparently tried to bribe a drug test collector because he missed seven tests. He's being suspended for 5 games. And before anybody gets all up in arms about, you know, getting suspended for marijuana, you don't get suspended for marijuana anymore. This is why I'm going to lead you through this, dear listener. And just experience just how incredibly stupid this whole ordeal is. So you find out Lyle Collins is being suspended, something to do with marijuana. And maybe you think like, well, that seems harsh. Okay. He missed 7 tests. And somewhere along the way, he claims that they were all legitimate. A couple of them sound like they might be legitimate, but this is the classic. Well, you missed the first 3. And then on the 4th time, that was when your uncle had died and it was the day of the funeral. But you already screwed up the other 3 previous times. Right. You established a pattern. At some point, he tries to bribe a collector. These guys are all, at least they were back when I was playing and you were playing. These guys are like retired DEA agents, retired FBI agents, and they only hire guys that had sterling records. And they're obviously like living on a nice, comfy pension somewhere.
They do it for the passion. Yeah. You know, they do it for the love of the game. They're not there for the big bucks. They have a code that they live by and they are there for the passion of staring at all these young athletes members and go, you better go directly in that cup. I love this job.
They do. They do stare right at your member. For those of you that have never had a drug test quite like that, they don't want you to be smuggling in a Wizinator or anything. So they stare at your penis while they're doing it. And they only use, you know, a couple of guys for each team for the most. They've expanded the program, so there's more guys now, but they probably get to know your member pretty well. So over time, if you tried to use a Wizinator, they'd recognize it pretty quickly.
It's not even that's not even like the embarrassing part is that they're that close, but it's just always the way that they give you like a rating afterwards that I always found to be so awkward. It's so I'm like 4 out of what? 5, 10?
I always picture, you know, there's like at least one guy on every football team that's like obscenely ridiculously like stuff you rarely even see in a porn movie.
Totally.
Like anatomically incorrect. You're just like, what the hell is that appendage? Like that,
that's obviously a tumor.
I always think of that scene in Boogie Nights, you know, when they first see Dirk Diggler. And Philip Seymour Hoffman's character is like, oh, oh, oh. I'm like, like so taken aback at the enormity of it. I always wonder if there's every now and then, maybe there's a drug test collector that's shocked by one of those dudes. It's like, okay, yeah. Here we go.
Right. He drops his cup of coffee. And then you're like, why were you drinking coffee?
Take your time, sir. This is the stage is yours. Just do whatever you. Okay. So we're not even done with how dumb Lyle Collins is. So then, so he gets suspended 5 games. The NFL says, hey, all right, NFL, or the NFLPA says, hey, NFL, this is too much. So the NFLPA negotiates the suspension down to 2 games. This is after Lyle Collins has missed 7 tests and apparently tried to bribe a collector at some point. Lyle Collins says, nuh-uh, I'm innocent. I reject your 2 games and I want to go to an arbitrator. So they take it to arbitration. And this is crazy. The arbitrator says, oh, no, this is crazy. You deserve 5 games. And he got a 5-game suspension. He was down to 2 and he just wouldn't stop about it. So he's back at 5.
It's one of those things where that it's obviously complete idiocy from top to bottom. I mean, you prefaced it with, it's not illegal anymore. It's not even what he did to himself. So then you're thinking like, okay, well, what were you worried about? I mean, what was going on? Like, what is there something else going on? But beyond that, it's just, it illustrates such a deep flaw in his decision-making that you're like, well, now we got a problem because you're an idiot. Like,
That's what I wonder, honestly, sometimes. And I think you and I have talked about this. I wonder about the whole Deshaun Watson situation where there's the current legal situation, but there's got to be a part to the Texans and other teams that thinks like, okay, what and who exactly is this dude that even if all of a sudden all the charges are dropped, this is a guy that apparently saw somewhere between 30 and 50 massage therapists in the course of a year, was obviously doing more, whether it was consensual or not consensual, whatever the allegations are true or not. Not to mention, there are other women out there who maybe have similar stories who haven't come forward. And all the, this isn't a class action suit, like where all of a sudden, once you settle these 22, nobody else can come forward. They could come forward. They could pop out of the woodwork whenever. And I don't mean that like with a negative connotation, pop out of the woodwork. We just don't know. I mean, there's at least one woman who's done an interview, two women that have done interviews that haven't pressed charges or filed for a lawsuit. So like with Lyle,
you're so fundamentally flawed in your ability to have any kind of good judgment that there's no guarantee you're not going to do this again.
It's kind of like Jameis. He's got judgment issues, and sometimes the judgment issues off the field don't transfer onto the field. But for him, it's like he's consistent across the board. He'll stand up on a picnic table and say bleeper right in the bleep on the quad. And he'll steal crab legs, and then he'll also like try to throw a 40-yard pass as he's falling to his back. No look. Like he's just got judgment issues, and there's just almost nothing you can do about it. You wonder with Deshaun, I think you have to worry about, okay, he's got more judgment issues than we thought. With Lyle Collins, I'd love to find out exactly what teams did and did not know about him on draft night. When he was a person of interest in the death of his ex-girlfriend, he wasn't a suspect or anything, but it made his draft stock plummet.
Yeah.
You wonder if maybe, because I at the time was saying, dude, take this guy in the second round because he's a first round talent and you never have to sign him. Wait until the legal stuff is over. Yeah. You never have to look like the team that has an employee who's a convicted murderer or anything. It was worth the risk to take him the second or third round. But I wonder if there was more to it, you know, like if he had enough judgment issues already on the scouting report that people were like, all right, this is enough.
Well, it's hard to, that's a good point. It's hard to tie any separate incident together like that as though they're necessarily related. But what it does tell you is that, as with all guys like this or just people in your life, I mean, outside of athletics too, there's always, when you're involved in something like that, there's just tends to be an aura of mania and dysfunction in general. There's just like a cloud that follows you because you're comfortable putting yourselves in those situations.
Yeah.
You're comfortable with kind of like the weirdness and everything else that just like devolves around you.
Well, yeah, I know you played with a guy like that. that really has managed to get through pretty much his entire career, right? Without ever having anything serious stick to him.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a handful of guys
I mean, in a city like, well, never mind.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to name names, but rhymes with, no. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking of even just like without going too far off the tangent, but when, you know, I think it was maybe like my second year, Jerome Mathis was in my draft class when we were in Houston. And when we got out there and he went to like the Pro Bowl his first year. And then he got a motorcycle in the off season. And do you remember this?
No, I don't.
This is how this all happened. He got a motorcycle and I saw the video where he had a motorcycle delivered to his house, his new super fancy house. And he wasn't like a big money guy.
Right.
He was drafted.
Right.
I think he was drafted after I was.
Yeah.
And he got there. He had it right off the flatbed, hopped on it, tried to do a wheelie on the street in front of his house, laid it down, broke his leg.
Oh, broke his leg. How it happened?
That's
oh,
how wow. it happened. Yeah.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
And then he never did, before the our rookie year in camp when we were staying at the hotel there.
Yeah.
He was, I mean, I'm going to assume that there's no kind of legal action here. Then, so if there is, then, you know, delete this part. But when we were staying in the hotel there, he spent a ton of his money on which was not a lot. As a signing bonus for when he was drafted, on a powder blue Escalade with Lamborghini doors.
Oh,
with Lamborghini doors that he had put on it, which was great because it's not designed to be that way. So water would leak in.
So, oh no.
Yeah. And I woke up at 3 a.m. I woke up at 3 a.m. and he was screaming or shouting and playing music. And he was on the hood of his car. And I look out the window and he starts shooting a gun. In the air.
Shut up.
Swear to God. He's shooting a gun laying on the hood of his car. And I was like,
what the hell? Oh my
God. This guy might not make it. This guy might not have it.
Was that before or after he went to the Pro Bowl?
That was like in training camp.
In training camp rookie year.
Yeah.
I remember one time. We were doing off-season workouts and I was gonna try to make a point about, you know, guys working hard and being rewarded for it and everything. And I was pointing out like how Andre and maybe somebody else, Andre Johnson, somebody else at the time basically won every single sprint. And then I was like, raise your hand if you've been to a Pro Bowl. And at that point I was thinking it was Andre and whoever the hell else I was thinking of. They're the only two guys that are to a Pro Bowl. Jerome Mathis raises his hand. And I'm like, oh fuck. Oh my hole!
This is not illustrating my point at all.
This is all screwed up now. Yeah, so basically, I was like, yeah, so, you know, ultimately, it doesn't matter. Some of us are just more blessed than others. you can run all day long. You're never going to be as good returning kicks as Jerome Mathis because Jerome Mathis has gone as a special teamer, as a returner. So. Yeah, those were good times.
yeah, good for him. I'm sure he's doing well somewhere right now. But I mean, the moral of the story is the delta between two games and five, if he had been managed appropriately and someone had just told him, which I guess tells you what kind of personality he must have, because there's no way his agent or someone else didn't try to beg him not to just take the two games.
Take this. And it's not, and you wonder, okay, for him to believe that he had 7 legitimate reasons to miss drug tests, and they work around your schedule. Like, they show up at your house. You don't have to come in or anything. Like, for him to try to, like, I think he might be one of those kinds of guys that really believes that he's innocent. You know, like guys that just flat out will not take responsibility, where there's just always something. I can remember getting into a discussion with a kid on the Texans who's that way, who was like, he came to me because he wanted me to talk to coach. And he was like, you know, my car, I got a flat tire, man. And I was like, yeah, but dude, you got a flat tire like 5 minutes from the stadium, like 5 minutes before the meeting was there. Like, if you'd gotten a flat tire in football, for anybody listening, like in football, like basically you plan on being an hour early to everything. It just wasn't, and if you get fined for it, you know, like if you were kind of pushing it and you got a flat tire 5 minutes away from the stadium, you just know you're going to get fined. You just, that's the way it is. It's just a higher standard. The guy that was the most rambunctious and thirstiest for this that I think maybe I've ever seen was Eugene Robinson, who got in trouble. Oh, he got arrested soliciting a prostitute the night before the Super Bowl. And I remember at the time, you know, like he was trying to do damage control. He was on his way home from winning a Man of the Year award, like NFL Man of the Year award, for all of the good work that he did, because he did do some good, did a lot of good charity work and everything. But on his way home, he decided to pick up a prostitute. It turned out to be an undercover cop. He got arrested the night before the Super Bowl. And I remember the time, if I recall correctly, it was being spun as, hey, you know, he got caught because he had kind of just, he kind of just lost it. The pressure got to him. He'd never tried to do anything like this before. And it was a really bad error in judgment. And, you know, just the poor guy. Like, that was how they tried to spin it.
Yeah.
He came and spoke to our team. Were you there when he came and spoke to the team?
I don't know. I don't think so.
One of those off-season programs. And he was hilarious because he was talking about, like, hey, you guys know how it is. You're in a new city. And you're just driving around and you're like, where's the titty bar?
Where are the hookers?
And you know, you just gotta find it. I'm like, man, I don't know.
You know how it is, right?
I don't know.
Right? We all know how it is.
I don't know if I know quite like you do.
I don't know. I don't know that at all, Eugene. You know, you're Googling where are the prostitutes. You know what it's like, Seth. You know,
some guy, some guy did that to Ted Johnson and I at the Super Bowl once. Did I tell you this story? We were broadcasting at the Super Bowl, and it was this kid. It was this little special teams player, really good special teams player from the Saints. He'd written a book at the time or something, and we were interviewing him, you know, a year or two after Deflategate. I think it was the year after Deflategate. That was when it was still a huge – or excuse me, not Deflategate, Spygate. No, okay. Not Spygate. Excuse me, Bountygate.
Bountygate. I was going to say the one that happened with the Saints.
Yeah. Yes. The very one.
Got it.
It was the year after Bountygate. And so he's talking to Ted and I, and he's talking about this on air. And he's like, well, you know, something, it wasn't a big deal. It was like, hey, you know, if we knock this guy out of the game, you get a couple $100. You guys know how it is. And Ted and I were like, no, I honestly have no idea what the hell you're talking about.
I don't know that.
I do not know what that is like. That was never a thing. But I think there were guys on that team that maybe there were other teams that had done stuff like that. But that's the classic one of those things that if you're involved with it, you feel like everybody must be involved with it or doing the same things.
Yeah.
But if you're not, it sounds like the most foreign, weird, ridiculous thing ever. Okay. So the one other thing that you had sent me, and we could do this real quick because I feel like we'll get in trouble if we don't. You sent me this Reddit thread. And I'm going to tell you right now, these Reddit threads are awful because every time I read one, I'll start getting into one of the conversations. And I'm like, man, these guys are making some really good points, and it's not really the way I would have thought about it, but I think they're making some really good points. And then 3 hours later, I'll wake up in bed and be like, oh, I really should not be allowed to vote.
I'm going down. Did I join QAnon? What just happened? The earth is not flat.
These guys make some really good points. So it started off with this article about Boeing, the airplane company, who was it in the 1940s? Basically bought a bunch of land outside of Seattle and put really restrictive racial like covenants in place that only white people are allowed to own property out there. And apparently they're still in place. And if you buy a piece of property there, it basically has a disclaimer that says, hey, we don't abide by any of these covenants or whatever thing. All those are null and void, or at least according to somebody on the Reddit thread. But the thread that caught my attention, and I think it caught your attention too, was where people said, you know, that this was pretty common back then, and it's right. And you know, like, so what are the common things right now that are going to be looked at with such anger, shock, or just derision 40 years from now? Well, what are we looking at, 80 years from now? And I do. I hesitate to even phrase it that way because it's like there's a different dynamic. Like they got into a discussion that is different than like the dominant race keeping like subjugating other races.
Yeah, that's like a clearly like there's racial tinge to it versus just kind of like a weird social norm that's right. Not going to be, you know what I mean? Yeah.
I say that, but now I mean, because it was like, you're like, racism in the 40s was so commonplace to the point where, like, to be anti-race, lots of people that were anti-racist or would have thought themselves were still pretty racist, you know, like Abraham Lincoln style of segregationists back in the 1860s, where Lincoln was still pretty damn racist, but progressive for the time. But you look at at some of his quotes now and you're like, oh my God, this guy's a monster. But it was,
it's all relative to the extreme.
Yeah. It's all relative. Yeah. Like, what are you compared to the dominant paradigm? But they got into this discussion, which is interesting about just, okay, what are we doing right now that's going to be looked at with disgust 100 years from now? And I think definitely I could totally see vegetarianism being like the dominant thing 100 years from now.
Just I think so too.
Either for economic or environmental reasons or something. Like, you could see somehow that flipping. Well, or like artificial meat becoming palatable if somehow that works out or something. Like, it's not outside of, it's not like that's what I want to happen or anything, but I could see it happening. And then like us all being looked on with disgust, like basically as being the equivalent of eating the family pets.
Same. Yeah. I could see it just being one of those things where the scales, where it just tips in the balance, where there's enough factors that just push it to where you're just shamed publicly for not being more open to just a completely non-meat based, or they're, you know, they're like doing now, you know, they're growing meat in labs and that's going to become like the dominant way to, you know, manage the supply chain.
That's true. And if so you could if you could grow a bunch of cows that didn't have brains, I'd eat the hell out of those. I mean, I eat the hell out of ones that have brains anyway. So
yeah, that's good for nightmares also.
I think that I know.
Well, like maybe we could just grow them without heads.
A nice hygienic, you know, matrix type of thing where you got them all living in a hive somewhere. It'll all be cool.
And yeah, that would be fine.
The other, and then somehow you could get the methane, you know, to turn into fuel that way more easily. You could recycle the methane from their farts and poop.
Yeah, yeah. Or we could eat vegetables.
I think the hardest thing is, look, you pretty much accept that almost everybody, including the segregationists back in the 1860s, were racists. But not everybody wrote about it and left records of it. Whereas with me, I've got multiple different tweets and photos and Instagrams of me like devouring mammals.
I was wondering where you're going with that.
Yeah. So I wonder if my great grandkids are going to be like, oh my gosh, yeah, I can't believe I go to Seth Payne Elementary.
Yeah. All the pictures of you like at the barbecue rib eating contest, like the annual. Yeah.
They're going to, well, the one that we're living right now completely and totally is homophobic slurs. Because you and I grew up
in a time
when that was like the standard currency of an adolescent boy. It was to throw homophobic slurs out left, right, up, down, wherever. You know, that was what you did. And I wonder, it's kind of a cliche almost at this point to say, well, boy, if there was social media when I was a kid. But that's true. I mean, if there were like home videos or what have you of you when you were 13 years old, you'd think you were a little bastard monster, right?
Oh, so completely. When you think about just in our lifetime, that's one of the ones that when you put that in the show notes, I thought like that is the perfect example, because that's like in our lifetime where it went from being prolific.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like how everyone talked to each other all the time, always. Dude. Dropping any number of kinds of like just homophobic slurs, like nothing.
Yeah.
Like it was completely fine. And now it's gotten to where obviously, I mean, where it should be. And
we understand. Like it was just so little awareness of just how it affected people, like, or how many actual homosexual or LGBTQ people that you knew but didn't know, you know, you never had a clue how many people you were affecting close to you, like in the same room, by shouting a slur at somebody, like, well, how devastating that is to that person.
Oh, totally. Totally. You know? I mean, a complete lack of like understanding. I think the difference with that, the only thing, and then clearly not to defend it, it's more just to provide context for it, is just that truly at the time, you're just like not even thinking of it or comprehending it as a commentary on someone's sexuality. That is not what's really going through your head. You're just like, oh, this is just a term that we throw out there. It's just, it's almost synonymous with dude or whatever else that you're using. And you're not even thinking about it in that way. Yeah. And then when it dawns on you at some point that that's not at all what's happening is when, you know, it kind of sinks
you're
in.
Like, you don't think, you're not consciously thinking of it, but in your mind, you've lumped in all those things together. They're like, oh, okay, well, there's something unacceptable or something undesirable or something gross or disgusting. Right. It's just that word, right? Yeah, I can remember the first time I ever really thought about it, and I still have, I wish I could find this woman, except I'd feel like such an incredible monster in trying to explain why I wanted to talk to her. I was at Cornell and we were walking up. So I was an adult at that point. I think I was in my sophomore year, so I'd have been 19 or 20 years old. And we were walking up to some function on campus at night, and I called some guy F word, you know?
Yeah.
And I kind of yelled it to him because he was a little bit away from me. And this woman who was walking by herself up the hill, like near us, up to a group of, we would have been like 7 or 8 football players and we're all linemen, you know? She says, kind of like with a smile on her face, she says, hey, leave the gays out of it or something like that. You know, and she looked, I'd like, if I had to guess, I'd guess she was lesbian. But she said it in kind of like a playful but stern way, you know, like in a little bit of an admonishment. And I can remember thinking like, oh, no, that's not what I meant. That's not what I meant. And then I thought about it afterwards. I was like, God, what does it matter what I meant? You know, like it's
exactly.
Not.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I like, and I've got so much respect for that woman because like I said, it was one woman talking to 7 or 8 huge dudes in the dark. And she kind of did it with, like she confronted us, but in a way that was, you know, still kind of playful in a way. And I like that haunts me still when I think about just how much courage it takes to be that person. And what a bastard I was in that moment without really having any clue about it until she pointed it out.
And it's the shift in perspective when you realize that it's not their job to have to understand or try to empathize with what you meant. That's not their job.
Right.
It's no one else's job to get to the bottom of what your intent was. Yeah.
You need to understand. Yeah.
Yeah. What you need to realize is that what I was doing was, and that's not their job. It's no one else's position to do that. I mean, I had that experience. I mean, when I was in high school, you know, like my longtime high school girlfriend, her parents had gotten divorced when she was young and her mom was a lesbian and had been with a partner for a long time. And I can't remember the specific thing that I said. It probably was the same thing. And I think I was calling it to like a buddy when we were hanging out and doing something. And she literally stopped me in my tracks in front of my friends. And she just said very plainly, she's like, that's hurtful.
Yeah.
She's like, that's hurtful.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, wait, I don't mean it like that. I didn't mean it like that. It's not even like that.
Right. Like,
she's like, no, she's like, you don't understand. That's hurtful. And I was like, oh man, it makes you feel, it's like, I'm not mad. I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh God. I mean, it just,
My sister was always really good about stuff like that, about just being very blunt and like stopped once and tried and basically told her to male friends or male white friends to get out of the car because one of them said something and the other one laughed and she's like, nope, that's it. Get out. And they're like, what are you talking about? And she ended up having like a 10-minute conversation on the side of the road with him about why she was so pissed off.
I bet he remembers though.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, man. I'm going to go eat a small mammal. I think.
Nice. Perfect.
I'm going to get canceled 30 years from now. Cause I mean,
so apropos. It's great.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you.
All right, man.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.